this need really wasn't particular to the middle of the 1970s, but it maybe came into focus in a particular way about that time, that there were lots of people who would fit the category demographically of the working poor. And the working poor were working, and yet there was no affordable housing for them. And the numbers were becoming increasingly large, and part of what was recognized was that that ability to know where you're going to live and having a place to call your own makes a huge difference in the life of a family that's trying to hold things together and find a way to move forward in life. But it was such a huge sort of societal problem that it was hard for people to get their minds around, like, what could we possibly do? And especially, what could just one or two people do facing a circumstance like that? Go about 30 years earlier to around 1947, approximately around that time, there was in a land far from us, a major city, there was a experience in this particular city of just rampant, extreme, unbelievable poverty. And it affected all across the society, but was perhaps most heartbreaking among the children, among those who didn't have adults to care for them, among the orphans of that society. And it was a staggering human problem. And it would be the sort of thing where you might say, what difference in the face of that sort of broad societal problem could one person possibly make? Or even one person with 13 friends, what difference could that person make? What could they do? We are on the fifth of 8 weeks of exploring discipleship. Different aspects of discipleship, what it means when we say we're disciples, we're followers of Jesus. And I enjoy this because I think it's important not just to say that we're disciples, but to say what that means and to understand there are sort of categories of discipleship, and there's ways of looking at our lives, not to judge ourselves, but to say, where am I in these areas? Is this something that's going on in my life, or is this something where I could grow? Is this something that I feel is very present, or something I feel is far away or missing? And so we've been working our way through these different categories or themes that relate to the general idea of discipleship. And this Sunday we're working on personal transformation, which is why I've begun with that question of what can one person do? Because what one person can do largely has to do with whether one person can experience a personal transformation in such a way that rather than looking at a situation and seeing something hopeless, where what we want to do is just throw up our hands and say, there's nothing really I can do, but to experience that transformation in our lives where when we encounter a situation that has the appearance of hopelessness, rather than despair, we say, I can impact this in some way. To have that bold confidence, that bold belief that what Jesus says to Jesus' followers is true, that an individual can make a difference, and that together we can make a vast difference. And not to lay that alongside of some of the huge problems facing the world, some of the huge problems facing the nation or our state, or even huge problems in our own lives that sometimes seem so big that we don't even know where to begin on them. But to say that rather than seeing despair and hopelessness as the option, we see possibility and we see opportunity. So we can either look at a situation and say, I accept my limitations. There is really nothing I can do here. Or we can figure out how God wants to work in us, to expand us, to help us to grow, to transform us and how that happens. And so we have two great scriptures this morning that in a way parallel each other. One seems like a smaller Old Testament version of a grander New Testament story, but both of them have similar dynamics in them. And there are some keys in both of them that have some wonderful parallels. So in the Old Testament scripture we read, we had the prophet Elisha. Not the prophet Elijah, but the person he mentored to replace him, Elisha. And someone brings Elisha the first fruits of their crops, the first fruits of what they have to offer. And so they bring 20 loaves of bread. There is a crowd around the prophet, apparently, at this moment. And what Elisha says is that we should use the bread to feed these people. There's at least 100 people, perhaps more. He says, give it to the people. Give the bread to the people so they can eat. And the answer that comes back is, how can I feed 100 men with this? Just looking at the limited supply and looking at the relatively large crowd, it seems unlikely that that's going to happen. But this is where we begin to get the instruction. This is where we begin to see God moving in the story, and it be the same in the other story, to give us an idea of how to do this. Nothing changes. Same food, same people, and the person who's looking at this and saying, how is this going to work for that? Elisha looks and sees an entirely different reality using the same information, using the same exact information, because as Elisha's been identified, Elisha is prophet of God. Elisha has this close relationship with God. So Elisha's response to the, how is this going to work for these people? He says, eat. Doesn't stop there though. He says, eat. And there will be leftovers. That seems unlikely to the person who doubts the whole situation will work out at all to begin with. But that's what Elisha sees, because Elisha is not looking at simply the facts on the ground. He's looking at the facts on the ground in light of God being active in them. And so he says, eat, and there will be leftovers. And that's how the story goes. The people eat, and there are indeed leftovers. I said this is a smaller version of a story. We get a similar dynamic in all the Gospels. This story shows up in each of the Gospels with slight variations. But we read from John's Gospel this morning, 5,000 people on the shore of the Sea of Galilee. You have probably heard hundreds and hundreds of sermons if you've been around church for any amount of time on Jesus feeding the 5,000. And so you've gotten used to this story, but it's worth bearing in mind the panic that the disciples would have had. The being separated from anywhere to do anything about this. You can't. There's no McDonald's nearby. There's no group of fast food places to send them and get stuff from. And even if they could, how would they pay for it? So you've got 5,000 people on the shore of the Sea of Galilee. There's this large crowd, and they're experiencing all these wonderful things with Jesus. Jesus healing and Jesus teaching, Jesus ministry. They're caught up in it. And while this is going on, the disciples have to be thinking, it's getting late, it's getting later, they're still here, we are going to have a crowd control problem before long. And so Jesus, recognizing this in them, asks this question to Philip. Now, scripture tells us he asks this question to Philip, he kind of knows where he's going with this, so he is wanting to Philip to work through this puzzle with him. But he says, where will we buy food for these people? Jesus knows the answer to the question is there is nowhere, anywhere nearby to buy food for these people. And even if there was a place nearby to buy food for these people, they wouldn't have the money and the resources in order to do that thing. But he asks the question. Philip, now remember the other story. How is this going to feed these people? Here we've got Philip looking at the realities before them. And Philip's answer is, it would take half a year's salary to do this. If we had half a year's salary. it would take half a year's salary to do this. And even if we did that, it would take that just for everybody to have a little bite. What he's saying is, we have serious issues here. We have an important problem before us that we're going to have to figure out. Andrew, and I'm not sure if he's trying to be helpful or highlight how hopeless the situation is, because it seems like Andrew's kind of like, I thought of this, and so I went and checked to see what people have, did a kind of an informal poll of the folks assembled here, and it turns out there's one young man, and he's got 5 loaves and 2 fish. He's reporting the inventory that's available to them. And again, that question comes up of, Andrew poses this very nicely for us, but what good is that? So on the one hand, he said, I found some food, but given the numbers that we would have to feed with it, it's really not even hardly enough for the one who brought it. I mean, that's the lunch for that person. So I found a little bit of food, but what good is that? There's two core questions in those two passages. In the first passage, it was, how can I feed 100 men with this? So again, looking at what's present there and saying, which is a rational thing. We can't come to these stories and say they should have trusted. You come to these stories and put yourself in the roles of these people, and we would be asking these questions. For instance, if we were going to have a large gathering here, and whoever was in charge of it showed up and said, I brought 5 loaves and 2 fish, and we were going to have 100 people to feed, we would be like, don't ever put them in charge of that again. That doesn't work. So there is a reality here that we want to side with the folks who it comes out right for in these stories, but if we're actually there, we would probably be with the people saying, how can we feed 100 men with this food? And so there's that question. And in the second story, Andrew's summation, what good is that? That would be our response. Again, if we had that situation occur here, somebody might come in with, you know, I got a couple of things, we got 100 people, and we'd say, well, that's fine. What good is it? How is that going to help? In these stories, you have a couple of individuals who see things differently, who look at the same circumstance, the same situation, but have an entirely different view or perspective on what can happen as a result of it. That would be Elisha, and it would be Jesus. And the two of them use this moment to teach, not just about how we get out of a difficult situation, but also how we look at whatever the circumstance is with different eyes. How we try to bring a different perspective, which is, you can look at it one way without factoring God in. But Elisha and Jesus are both saying, let's factor God into the equation. Let's imagine that if God created the situation, there's a solution for it. So what they want to do is they want to provide a moment of transformation for those people who are present. They want to transform one perspective at a time. Again, putting yourselves into the story, if you were among those 100 people and you had a look at what was available to eat and you thought, I'm pretty hungry, you might have some doubts until it happens and there's plenty of food for you. And if you're on that hillside and you've been out there all day and suddenly it occurs to you that you're hungry and you see that group of people up there who you thought were in charge, and when it comes time for the box dinner, there isn't one. And now you're really, really hungry, and you see they got, it looks like 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. You're thinking there's not going to be anything, but then there is. And there just is more, and there's more, to the point that you can't believe it, but at the end they're walking around taking up what's left over because they don't want to waste any. They end up with 12 baskets. If you're in either of those crowds, what happens to your perspective about what's possible? I think you move the needle a little bit. I think your perspective changes just at least ever so slightly, maybe a lot, so that what once seemed impossible, well, now if that's possible, what else is possible? And again, what Elisha and what Jesus are pointing to is that with God as a part of the equation, lots of things are possible that we think aren't possible. The things that you might be able to do might include changing the world. The answer to the first question I gave you this morning, so you remember I was asking you a question about the public housing and people being able to afford a house, and there are more people that don't have homes and people need homes. There was a couple, and they were on the Koinonia farm down in Georgia in around 73, 74, and they had this idea while they were there, and so they went actually to Zimbabwe. And while in Zimbabwe, over the course of 2 or 3 years, they started building houses for people and trying to decide if this was a sustainable thing. If they started building houses with people and the people helped them and had some ownership in the process, could this work? And those people are Millard and Linda Fuller. And in 1976, they created Habitat for Humanity. So Habitat for Humanity is born out of them having this idea, seeing an insurmountable problem, and then beginning to do something about the insurmountable problem that two people can't possibly address. Over the course of time, Habitat for Humanity continues to work to the point where Habitat for Humanity International, and these are 2013 figures, but by 2013, Habitat was putting up its 800,000th home. Two people had an idea of what might happen. And over the course of that time, thousands and thousands of people caught that idea, caught that vision along with them. And is there still a problem? Yes. But have 800,000 homes been built to address that problem? Absolutely, yes. And a huge difference has been made, not just in the lives of the people in those homes, but also in the lives of all those people who made that possible. Personal transformation took place. People began to see that things that they thought they couldn't have any impact on, they could have an impact on. They changed the way the world works. Another example, what could one person do in a place like that where there was just such incredible poverty and the orphans were on the street and the health situation was terrible? And you may have guessed that the place I'm talking about is Calcutta, and the person is Agnes Gumsha Bojakshu, Mother Teresa. And the 13 people that were with her at the beginning, that was when she began her Missionaries of Charity. And from her and those 13 people facing an insurmountable human situation of poverty and poor health and just heartbreak of the orphans, has grown this incredible network of orphanages and of charitable centers, all out of her vision that while it was overwhelming, she had to try to do something. And it grew and it grew and it grew. But perhaps those stories still seem a little far off. Like those are someone else's stories. And it's kind of like when we have hero stories from the Bible and we hear that and we think, it's great for the heroes from the Bible, but what about us? The numbers we face can be too great. There's too much to do. We have too few resources. We know that we can't have an impact. We know that something can't be done. Pastor Cheryl Bridges Johns has this wonderful sentence. She said, at the end of knowledge stands Jesus. We know that something can't be done, but at the end of knowledge stands Jesus. And Jesus is there to stand and tell us that something absolutely can be done. That there is something that each one of us, with our lives personally transformed by that relationship with Jesus, can do. Ray Baker was talking to me yesterday at the Bible school gathering about Operation Christmas Child shoeboxes. I want to point this out. Literally, so that was July 28th. Literally, Christmas in July. But Ray's thinking shoeboxes in July. person could look at poverty and children in the world, and we could say, there's so many children and there's so much poverty, what could we possibly do? Somewhere along the way, Operation Christmas Child captured Ray's passion. And along with it, it captured our passion. And so he's got it on his mind a lot of the time, thinking, what can we do? How can we grow this thing, improve it, make it more user-friendly for people so they can participate? And people buy in. People want to participate and do this. And I've heard from family after family, especially ones with little ones, talk about how important it is that when they go to get the things for the boxes, and how much the children, how much the thought they put into putting these things together for the child they don't know, but whose life they're going to make a difference in. There is a problem we can't have anything to do, we can't impact, except we can when we begin to think about, how can I actually do something to make a difference? VBS. We typically have 25 to 30 children over the course of the several nights. Might say, is the time that goes into the preparation for it and the time that we have that when we're here, is it really impactful to do something when 25 or 30 children, and what difference can that make? And I would say all the difference in the world. Absolutely all the difference in the world. Because when you touch 25 to 30 children, there's an exponential spinoff from that. Those children have friends. And those children relate to their world differently because people here cared about them and loved them. And it impacts on those of us who get to do that as well. Because children can just light you up. They can just renew your belief in how important these interactions are. I shared in Sunday school, there was one young man who came here on Friday night. And it was the only night he came to Bible school. And he came back Saturday for the closing program, and we had decided this year we were going to bring back the certificates to give to the children and stand and read their names and give them each a certificate. And that might seem like a who cares big deal thing to you on the cosmic scheme of things, but this was so amazing, and it tells you what difference just even the smallest action done with care can make. On that last night, we were handing those things out. And so I was watching that young man, and I know what he was thinking. He was thinking, I was just here one night, and I'm not going to get one of those. And it came to that moment where the teacher, Amanda, read his name, and I had my eyes on him, and he was kind of looking a little bit sad. And when she said his name, he went, yes! That's what difference Vacation Bible School can make, and it replicates in so many lives. Marty's Kitchen, same story. So many hungry people in the world. What can we possibly do? Well, go participate in something where people are feeding some of those hungry people, and you've begun to move the needle in the opposite direction. We can make a life in the lives of people who show up. And again, as we do it, we're transformed. We become somebody different than we were before. We begin to experience hopefulness where hopelessness had been. We get hope instead of despair. Elisha and Jesus aren't simply showing that God is powerful. They want something beyond that. They want the people who see that God is powerful to understand that they can participate in this. That just as they're experiencing this incredible, miraculous moment, they can carry this out there and they can be agents of that kind of powerful, miraculous moment. They are transforming people so that those people can transform people. And they are going to leave behind people, and what we hope we leave behind is people who believe more is possible. Not that you have to accept things and live with it as it is, but people who believe that more is possible. So let's do the math. 20 loaves of bread, 5 loaves and 2 fish, 100 shoeboxes, maybe a total of 50 to 60 people at Bible school on any particular night, 100 people fed at Marty's Kitchen. What difference could it possibly make? It just might change the world. and there will be leftovers. Thanks be to God.